I've got Lark Cumby, who's rather new to radio, other than the fact that he's a great call-in guest, and I'll let him explain about himself a little bit. And then I've also got Nikki Rapana, and I've had her on before, and I'm having her back, but I've had Lark join us, and then I've got a kind of a DJ in training, William Wallace, that's kind of sitting here, too, to kind of maybe fill in here a little bit. But I don't know if this is a term he's familiar with on communitarianism that is Nikki's forte, and Lark has definitely picked up on it and decided to become a scholar, student, whatever of it, in his own right. So, Nikki, do you want to explain a little bit about your background, and then I'll go ahead and let you do so, Lark, as well. Nikki, go ahead.
Okay. I've been studying Etzioni's work since March 30th, 2000. I went to my first community meeting on March 30th in 1999. And from that point forward, I spent a lot of time researching all the new terminology that the group was using to justify invading our private homes in Seattle. And it took me a year, and then I found the originator, Dr. Amitai Etzioni. He's a sociology professor at George Washington University. And Etzioni opened all the doors, you know, because they have been writing about communitarianism since Bill Clinton and the promise of communitarianism by William Galston. I mean, these people have been touting this for quite a long time, you know, to each other, though, okay, not to mainstream America, not to mainstream Europe, but certainly among themselves. So it wasn't hard to find a lot, and my research website ended up growing into a monster that is unnavigable, really, to, you know, honestly, at this point. It's like an encyclopedia or something, you know. Somebody someday needs to go in and fix the whole thing, and it won't be me. Promise you that, you know, because I just can't. It became overwhelming. So now I mainly just blog and, you know, other things too. Today I've expanded my interest to political economy and, you know, making money and being in business and seeing how the system actually can work or if it can't, you know. So that's pretty much me.
And Lark?
Well, I actually was studying several things at once, including branding and marketing and aspects of psychology and philosophy, and somehow stumbled onto this term communitarianism. And as soon as I saw the word, I thought, this is an odd word. I'm not familiar with this. And this was about 4 years ago, and which eventually led me to Nikki's work with the Anti-Communitarian League, and then naturally to her blog, Living Outside the Dialectic. And so I've been quite a keen student ever since.
Well, before,
how did you stumble on it, Lark?
Pardon me?
The term, how did you stumble on it? Where did you hear it first?
You know, I can't really say. I just know that for me, I was looking for a simpler way to live. I mean, I'm in my mid-50s, and I've known what it's like to work like a dog for years, and I know what it's like to have owned a nice home and lost a nice home and owned a business for a dozen years. And for me, since I had the luxury of time to be able to do some research, and coupled with the fact that I'm rather a Luddite, I've got a huge library, but I don't, I never got on a computer until 2004. And so, I can't honestly answer that question except to say that when I did stumble upon it, I was fascinated by, Nikki, your work, and realized the enormous effort that had gone into it.
Well, you guys, let me do one thing before we take it any further, and I just want to say the views expressed on this program are those of myself and are my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHAN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. Now, Nikki, I don't know whether we want to go back and kind of revisit a little bit of how, you know, some of your prior work or in background, or if we want to kind of, unless you got something that you've been working on that we should kind of just take it a step further, or Lark, did you have something a little bit in mind on how you wanted to address this?
Well, as far as community...
You what now?
Go ahead, Lark.
Okay.
Sorry.
Okay.
Well, I have to say that... my goodness, Nikki has certainly blazed the trail. Because first of all, to go into the study of communitarianism and communitarian law from a academic standpoint that is steeped in the stuff and thoroughly indoctrinated to it, literally embracing it, is quite dull and very, disconcerting. But with Nikki breaks things down from a layperson standpoint, because she recognizes immediately that there's something wrong with this. And so I appreciate her point of view terms of the study of communitarianism, but it is a rather dry subject. But with Nikki, she puts some of her personality.
Mm-hmm. Oh, all my personality is in it. I think these people are criminals and crooks. And I've been trying to debate Amitai Etzioni on what he tells you communitarianism is and what I can prove that it is are not the same thing. I always thought it would make a very interesting debate, a public debate, in front of the people who are affected by the programs and the policies and the new regulations that come from the theory. It's not theory anymore. It's law, and it's been law for a long time, and that was my main contention with these people, was that they were passing laws inside community development plans that affected the entire community, said the entire community wanted it, and nobody in the community even knew they passed it. Happened all the time, and it's still happening to this day all over the world. I am writing an article right now for Brian Garish's publication called The UK Column. It'll be coming out across England, I guess sometime this weekend. A big ad to one of my supporters in London, or Southampton, I say that like I'm from Wisconsin, don't I? I can't imagine how you say that in London, you know, but anyway, I'm writing for an English audience tonight, and I'm also writing without my computer. It crashed about a month ago, as Lark knows, because all of a sudden I no more blog posts from me, and I've been doing a lot of other things that are good, really healthy for me, it seems like. Whenever I need to get off the computer, my higher power takes care of me and something crashes or the phone line goes out or whatever, you know. And I have learned over my lifetime to go, okay, I'm not supposed to be doing that right now. And then I turn and there's always something else in front of me, you know, like my dishes, you know, or go get wood, or, you know, get the water, take a shower, just get away, you know, and get back into other things. So, you know, part of my study of communitarianism is how they've destroyed our economy. And I do still study certain things, like I just learned what private equity firms do and how they're helping to undermine American business.
Nikki?
And global business. They're global. And the Carlyle Group is one of them. I was just, you know, I'm still shocked by certain things.
Nikki?
So I'm still studying as far as what they're doing and how they're doing it, because I feel like as a 53-year-old woman, I have never tried to engage my community in business. Not really. I had a restaurant for a while, but I was still trying to help the poor and stuff like that back then. Now, I mean, you know, just make money and make it building things, these little girdies that I make, and selling them to people who are interested in alternative housing, tiny houses, you know. I think there's a small market, maybe growing, who knows. But I just to try it, you know, and be I defend all these political economic theories, and I've never practiced any of them. You know, so I'm like, what am I talking about? I don't know. When I'm, you know, I'm talking about Lisch theory of political economy, for instance, the 1841 publication that we cite in our manifesto, it's still theory. I'm like the kid that went to school and read all the books about this stuff, but I never actually did that. I'm a bartender. I was in entertainment industry for years, music, singing. So, you know, as far as business practices and being part of the global economy and what that means, I'm a novice at that. So all of those studies that I've done that were against them, I also feel like I wanted to learn, you know, something positive through the whole experience. You know what I mean? It's been 11 years. You cannot stay in the opposition mode with a theory for that long and remain sane, you know?
Nikki, I'm just wondering now, when you're writing for a press over in the United Kingdom, are you saying that people around the world are really picking up on what communitarianism is about?
Well, I don't know that all over the world. I know that they already know what it is in Asia. It's a common term. They use it frequently. From Philippines, China, you know, the Japanese understand the term too. So different areas of the world have been exposed to the word, and they're not looking to my work necessarily to understand it. It's the European nations that already have departments of communitarian this and communitarian that. You know, look at all Romania, Czech Republic, all of the nations that are coming into the EU. Set up a communitarian bureaucracy under the supremacy of communitarian law clause, which is the clause that the French and the Dutch rejected the first unification treaty that they, actually, it was through referendum. They weren't really asked. They just went and did it anyway, I guess, you know, and rejected it because of the supremacy of communitarian law. Now, it didn't come out with the Irish. The first time the Lisbon Treaty was defeated there, I thought, I had hoped that it would because I had quite a few people from Ireland at my website, but obviously they weren't, they didn't have an audience. So even when people find my work, Melody, they don't normally have an audience. Your journalists are not looking up communitarianism. They're not, you know, very few journalists even have ever heard the term. And if they do hear it, they just repeat it and move on.
So you're saying this is more of an understandable term for people that are outside of this country, but in this country, it seems to be, you know, not an understood terminology. Is that correct?
No, and in England, it's not either. Ireland is not either. The EU, the common man in all of the world, no, it's not a familiar term. Who's familiar with the term are the stakeholders, people who have a financial interest in these plans, these community development, sustainable development plans, are all about gathering all the resources and all the assets in your local community. If you're in on the plans and you know what communitarianism is, you can steal everything from your neighbors.
Well, one of the interesting one of the interesting things that I've had Lark sending me some information on, and he may have been sending it to you as well, but and I think it ties right in with this communitarian term, is the verbiage and how things are kind of blurred in their terminology. Because he sent me something, I believe, just recently on the term republic, and Lark, would you like to elaborate a little bit on that, or?
Well, what interests me after studying community law and so forth and so on for the last 4 years is how easily duped we really all are when we take sides in any kind of a conflict or debate. And so I think it was really Nikki that alerted me to the fact that once you know about communitarianism and also as you understand how the Hegelian dialectic works in just common parlance, then we see how we're all easily misled. And so for me, what I like to do is take note of the myriads of definitions for common words that we all bandy about unthinkingly. And so one example that I used is we talk about in political circles, well, the United States of America is a republic. Well, no, it was declared a democracy with the bankruptcy in 1933. And so we have all these arguments going back and forth, but we know that there are so-called stakeholders in think tanks and foundations, NGOs, et cetera, that are actually guiding this debate through the media and through their bought and paid for public voices. So if you were good to go into Wikipedia, for example, and just simply look up the word republic and then go into where this word came from, the Latin term re publica, and then just look at all the different definitions, you see that we're talking past each other. We're not even talking the same language in most cases.
Right,
and so we're being easily misled constantly.
That one was really enlightening just on, and it's not that I subscribe to Wikipedia tremendously, but just the fact that, boy, they were just showing the difference in the terminology back in the Roman times between their own definitions, if I'm following correctly what they were trying to demonstrate. Is that, am I saying that right, Lark?
Well, I think the vision for this country, for the so-called elites of their time, was really rather like Plato's Republic, which to my mind is more of a communist state than it is anything that I thought was American. That's just only one example.
And so, but
so,
what
I find is that they like to take a term that is a feel-good term, too. You know, the good. They love that word. You know, I mean, the common good, you know.
Yeah.
And like, they do. And so that when you say, no, I'm for the common bad, you know, because you're automatically placed into a dialectical position with everything they say. And if they predetermine the argument, as well as they do, and they do, absolutely, then they take the upper moral side, and the only one left to you is the immoral side. So you end up having to argue for immorality, and that's not your reason. That's never your reason. It's like, it's so hard to argue with them because they'll say, like, okay, I go to my neighborhood association and I say, you have to stop these plans. These plans are overreaching the authority that has been vested even in the elected representatives, let alone unelected representatives, you know. Let's be reasonable here, I said, you know. And they say to me, don't you want to live in a nice community? So I have to say, no, I want to live in a really terrible community. You know? So and that's the argument now, suddenly. And I laughed right in their face because I fortunately took a class called Logic and Critical Thinking at Chico State University in 1982 from a wonderful professor named Marianne Bertram, and she was a practicing attorney in Sacramento at the time, too. And Bertram, I tested her bad. I took her every paper I wrote that whole semester in college and asked her to grade them all for me because I knew I was illogical. I was such an emotive reasoner when I first started school. I had no idea. You know, I wrote a paper about, you know, the pharmaceuticals and Depo-Provera and women's contraceptives and stuff, and I said that I bet Johnson & Johnson was worried about how many Tampax they wouldn't be selling and things like that, you know. Which, you know, this doesn't belong in a research paper, you know, but I peppered my papers with that. So what happened when I had to start writing about communitarians, I knew I was the wrong person for the job because not only was I over-emotionally involved in the pilot test for their stupid new invasive program that they were doing, which was control all private property, which is now part of cap and trade, and all kinds of stuff. It's in the stimulus package, everything. All those programs that they tested on me in Seattle were not little benign and inconsequential programs, because now with the new laws and these new the way they're hiding it behind this whole green environmental, you know, agenda is brilliant. These people are brilliant. The people who plan to control the world through a central government bureaucracy are not stupid people, but they think you and I are. And that's what made me mad. And it always takes me to that put them up place, you know? So I'm not the best man to go out and talk to them either.
You're so impolitic, Nikki. I love you for that. But I have to say, you're so politically incorrect. Impolitic.
Impolitic, that's a term? I love it. I'll wear it. I'll put it on. It's not living outside the dialectic. It's impolitic and outside the dialectic. Yeah.
But I'll tell you something that really chaps me, besides the fact that I don't really like arrogant people. And I recognize these qualities even within myself over the years and have fought to subdue them, if you will. But I just don't like this baloney about always having to dialogue to consensus and compromise. Do you notice that's considered the moral truth that we're supposed to aim at these days is something called consensus. Dialoguing to consensus. And many times I say to myself, if not out loud, I mean, this is bullshit. I don't have to dialogue to consensus.
You can't
say
that.
I have my view, and this is my position, and that's it, and I stand on it.
Okay, Lark, we can't say that on the radio.
Oh, my, I'm so sorry. Now I'm being in politics.
You know, I just wrote a graph about that same thing tonight as part of this article that I'm writing in by hand, which is just amazingly different than writing on the computer. That was the thing, you know. But I have journals all my life, but usually I didn't like writing anything about communitarianism in hand, just because I was so used to writing in my journal by hand that I would just write whatever I thought. And that is what I have to do again, you know, because what I think is what I know. And I wrote, the only common consensus I've ever seen defining the common good comes from our enlightened betters who assure us there's nothing common about them. They can practically levitate, they're so advanced, almost off the scales of human evolution into gods. What mere common mortal dares to challenge them? Every damn one of them if they ever get asked, but they don't get asked if that's at all possible. You know, to let commoners decide their own common destiny disrupts the entire objective of the common purpose. And that's really how I feel about that, too. When they told me they had already reached consensus in Seattle on the neighborhood plan, I'm like, who? And what does that mean? I never heard that word. And I got A's in political science and U.S. history. You know, I should know what that means, you know? And then I went to the WTO's website in 1999 because I was like in Seattle during the Battle of Seattle and all that stuff was going on. I was trying to figure out what the WTO was because I had never heard of it. You know, I'm Alaskan and I stay rural a lot of the time and I don't pay any attention to what's going on in the world because I don't care. And I never thought it affected me the way that it really does. And most Alaskans that I know still don't really, you know, want anything to do with any plan or program that they have, you know, and to tell people that there is a plan and your land has already been designated a wilderness area in the Yellowstone to Yukon project. You're claimed by EcoTrust to be a member of the Salmon Nation Cascadia project in the 70s, you know. I mean, this stuff is still all going on, and they are taking more and more land away from people, which on the land is the resources that developers need in order to create industry and jobs, but just shutting down the country. And it has been since the owl crisis, even before that. Ketchikan, you know, all these cities in Alaska that used to be fishing towns and logging towns are ghost towns now for the tourists coming from, you know, the Netherlands on Dutch ships worked by international kids, slaves. They have their own little slave groups that travel and work at all their lodges. There's no local, the locals do not benefit from the Prince's Tours being in Alaska any more than they did, you know, 200 years ago when we were colonies, you know. We're colonized now already, and it's like we can't even recognize it.
Isn't that amazing how they can, I mean, that it reminds me of something that my brothers used to do to me when I was one of them anyways, and he would say, you know, he'd be punching on me and whatever, and he'd keep yelling out loud, "Stop hitting yourself, stop hitting yourself." You know, and it's like,
that's my family too, yeah. It is. And so much of it is childish that when you're, you know, when you, these people become, what's that word, petulant, you know, that where they'll pout, and they would say things to me like, "Nikki, I just don't understand what you want from me. I'm trying to help you." You know, and I'm asking them for definitions. That was it. You know, and Doc's right. You go to the definition. What do they mean by that? Say, "What do you mean by that?" And they go, "What do you mean? What do I mean?" They can't define any of their stuff. Etiotti can. You know, they'll take 3 books to, you know, make it so that you never ask that question again because you're so bored by the answer. They're very long-winded. So when you quote them, you know, your paper just turned into a 2,000-word paper instead of 500-word paper, and they still, you know, I mean, most of the criticism against political communitarianism is its vagueness.
And it,
you know, that's about as far as anybody goes. They can't understand it, but it can't mean anything to them, you know.
Well, if it isn't vague, they have several different words that are blurred, you know, between the world, words like liberal to socialist to communist to, you know, and then when it really comes out in the wash, when you find it, it doesn't matter. I've come to the point where it doesn't even really matter what the differences between these different isms or ists that are out there, because it all is the same guys at the top controlling the whole situation. So
and communitarianism has, what it has done is balanced capitalism, communism, socialism, totalitarianism, fascism, nationalism, okay? Because don't you know, nationalism is a problem. It's a political ideology whose time has come and gone, okay?
As is individualism.
Yes, exactly. Nationalism and individualism, to me, always seem to go hand in hand, but that's because I practice American exceptionalism, according to the socialist people I know. You know?
That means your opinion, so my goodness.
I had to go look that up, too. You know, I'm like, what does that mean? When they called me a constitutionalist at the first meeting I was at, I was like, what does that mean? Is that bad? Is that a bad thing? No, I'm not, you know, I'm not trying to cause trouble. I just want to know when your police raids are going to start in my neighborhood, you know? I mean, these people are crazy. They do things like cordon off entire blocks and go to every house and take hostages and stuff. I mean, it's like you're in Puerto Rico in the 50s or something. Or El Salvador in the 70s. I mean, some of the practices by the community police, who are always on the community development committees, and they're also called community service officers, and you see them all over the world now. They're in every country that's affiliated with the UN, 100 and whatever it is, 92 nations now, okay? They all got it. They all passed the Domestic Violence Act in 1995. Some of them are exactly the same words. The English and the Australian, the New Zealand one, I've studied several of them, the ones that are in English, okay? But Manila had, Philippines had theirs. They all have the same Domestic Violence Act, and nobody's asking why. Because it's all communitarian. And if they don't understand communitarianism, then why would they go look up any communitarian legislation that's being passed around the world? And it has been. That was 15 years ago.
Well, you know,
and how many lives have been destroyed by that?
The hard part for, I think, for some people is the fact that even if it, you know, is become a one-world government, and that's where, you know, exactly where we're headed, it's the end result that these guys have in mind that's the hardest part to even try to get across to them, because they haven't even figured out the first step, let alone the last step.
That they're the sacrifices to the gods.
You're serious.
I'm calling them. I have this thing where, this, I hope this doesn't violate your thing, but I'm writing this article, and I'm just like, it's kind of like, it's like a free thought thing starts coming out, you know. And I'm like, national referendums and national votes always seem to favor the national good. you know, which always conflicts with the common good. And nations of voters still care too much about their local economies, their authentic stewardship of their private lands, and very few people will invite you to poop in their drinking water. And unless you can convince them, you have a better way to use their foot. I stopped, you know, and I was like, what the heck is this? But that's really what I'm trying to get across to people, is that they're smiling while they're taking a dump in your wall.
Yeah, but you know, that's probably more literal than you want to realize.
Well, you know, that's another thing too. I mean, the control of the public drinking water, the control of the public, of the commons, because there used to be commons. Villages had wells. That was standard. Villages had rules. Villages threw you out at night if you didn't own property there. Vagrants weren't even allowed to stay in the cities. All of these policies that people used to be able to, you know, to defend themselves against strangers, are off the table now. And anyone who thinks that they have a right to defend themselves against anybody is, you know, politically incorrect. So I'm not alone. Because most everybody I ever talk to, you know, they will defend what they think is theirs, what they think they have the right to defend. So that's why they gotta blur the lines and tell them, no, no, we're defending you. So the person goes, really? Oh, well, it doesn't look like that, but okay, you know? And then the bottom line is how, you know, how prepared have you been? Did your education prepare you to accept whatever they say? Or were you a dropout and made some few choices of your own? You never know. You know what I mean? How that all, why people come to the point where they can look at this openly and then grieve, because you have to grieve. To find out most everything you've ever been told is a lie is a really horrible experience. And you can't minimize that for anyone, you know? So I don't promote the ACL. I don't promote my manifesto. I push my thesis at the academics. And I stay in the academic world, but I don't, anybody else. You know, I can't. It drives people crazy.
Go ahead, Laura.
I have a 20-something niece that just got her degree in, I think, in geography and Spanish. And so here's a young woman, very bright, attractive lady. She's going to do well in the world, but you know something? She's completely indoctrinated. She is a communitarian. It astonishes me when I even speak to her. She almost feels like a foreigner. In many respects, she's quite lovable, but indoctrinated all the way.
But again, unless we address, Lark, the fact that where this is going beyond here, a lot of people are not going to see that there's a problem with it. I mean, you're not going to be able, and I know that you got to take it in steps, but at the same time, the end result is what. Is the how do we take that point where, you know, your niece, how have you approached her on what's going on, or do you think she would even, you know?
Well, see, now you're touching upon my particular study and my particular approach, because I have to look at the reality. I mean, Americans don't read. They're conditioned to instant gratification. They're conditioned to accepting the rapid technological advances in the world, which, in my view, will totally enslave all of us. And so for me, I try to discover memes, what we call memes, what we also know as mimetic imprinting, in the way that we use shorthand and acronyms and sometimes even aphorisms, etc., to be able to construct certain realities for ourselves. And one of the simplest things that we can do as Americans is simply ask ourselves, are we or are we not independent? And if we're not independent, do we have a right to be? So I ask myself questions, but they're my questions. And so what I do is I try to encourage through my writing for other people to do the same thing. I mean, to what extent are you a codependent or are you necessarily interdependent? And what comes first? Who is the final arbiter for you? And so,
Clark, do you remember with the hexa-year guy that came in on my blog and was arguing for his plan to humanity, to save humanity?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, that guy, that's the first time I heard this, but I went and checked it out. Now, one of the problems with talking to people like, you know, anyone who's been indoctrinated into the philosophical belief behind it, which is very open, like the communitarian residence life movement in the colleges in the United States is very open. It's a real thing. And it is part of their whole culture. It's the bottom line to everything that they're doing in the dorms, for sure. And
yeah, it's the democratic way. It's the truth, it's the fairness and justice.
Right, and what this guy told me was that, you see, I predicate everything, as you do, because we're Americans, on the natural rights theory, you know, the negative rights, that I have the negative right to tell you what you cannot do to me, you know, and that whole understanding of where Bill's rights come from, well, they came from my creator. And no man gave them to me, no man can take them away. We come from that place. But these people that have been indoctrinated are being told that we only rent our bodies from Mother Earth, who we have a national religious holiday called Earth Day, and this is like all tied into communitarian thinking, because if you only rent your body from Mother Earth and you're only borrowing the space that you're on, then you have no rights whatsoever.
Well, see, that comes from that word human. Yeah, that comes from that word human from a deeper level. And human connotes that we came from the soil. Well, which is not altogether true. In fact, it's not true at all that we're even human as a noun. We're actually beings. And human is really only the adjective to describe that word being. So what we see is that we're being misled by people who are arrogant, think themselves are betters, that truly want to actually dehumanize us so that we don't know who we are.
So back to Melody's question, I mean, how do you explain that to your neighbor in between commercial breaks of Biggest Loser?
Well, you know, very often you just simply can't explain to people, you know. However, you know, when we have internet radio like we're on right now, we can begin at least to get the word out for people to at least question some of these things and understand how we're being literally battered back and forth. And how is it this is happening? It's because of the language, constructs, the words, the letters, the feelings, the perceptions, the signs, the symbols, the numbers that we're indoctrinated to accept as authoritarian, and we don't question them. We have to question everything
So there has to be like a deprogramming program, like what
yes.
they have to do for the religious cults. You know, if you go find your family
yeah.
member and they're held captive by a religious cult, and they tell you, this is my real family now, you know? Well, that's basically what the community... that's what the communitarians are doing, too, is that your allegiance to your old family is archaic. It's almost like Cambodia under Pol Pot, you know?
Yeah, and you have to say, like, who says... Like, you have to say, says who and why.
Yeah.
And if you don't ask these questions, you cannot possibly be independent. Why? Because you're not independent of mind. And you're not applying critical thinking. You're essentially being swept up into somebody else's authoritarian construct.
This has got to be the dilemma facing the Tea Party people that are authentic right now, in my opinion, okay? It's because, the bottom line is, you have a whole dupe population that's going along with everything. They don't even know what the heck's going on, right? You know, right? So,
yeah.
If you wanted to declare yourself a new leader of a new organization and not ever explain it to the people that can't understand who they're following anyway, Is that morally correct? Is that good behavior? Would that be a good decision for someone to do? To not try and explain communitarianism to someone who's never even been able to spell communist or capitalist or understood either system, how can you explain the synthesis between capitalism and communism to someone who's never even studied either one of those? And they don't even know what free trade capitalism is as opposed to Adam Smith's capitalism and Hugh Hobbes and all those Ludwig von Mises and all that libertarian right-wing wacko stuff as far as I'm concerned, okay? They take it way too far. Their whole selfish individualist ideology, I don't think that was ever American, personally, okay? I think it was a very cooperative country because we had to cooperate with a whole lot of people or we would have died. And the few people that I know that recognize the contributions of the indigenous peoples and what happened to all them poor Indians down in Haiti and Cuba and everything, you know? And we know what we did to all those people, but my generation, we don't take responsibility for those acts, and we live a very different world. That's the world I defended in Seattle. But, you know, what an illusion that is, really. So the thing is, this is something I get letters and pleas all the time to lead people. And I tell them I haven't got a clue how to do it because I don't know how to lie to you all. Maybe somebody else does. For your own good, of course, you know? That's the game. That's the stupid game. That's the chess game that's being played in the City of London with our futures right now. How are we going to get in it with any clout whatsoever?
That's it, you know.
Lots of people.
I mean, one of the things that it's kind of becoming clear to me, but that doesn't mean I know where to go with it much further than this. But I mean, when you're really dealing with people that are liars and deceitful and that sort of thing, and yet they always seem to find a new way to reinvent themselves so that we fall back in line under their spell. And that's what I'm really come to the term of it is we're under their spell. And they use terminology and code words and things like that. It's just like, I watched this with the Obama campaign where some of those words that they utilized, it was like their eyes glazed over. And and then I thought, oh, that's really bizarre. But, you know, I had a situation happen to me. I was doing some massage work and I was trading out with a good friend who was a doctor in hypnosis and that sort. So I took a few, you know, she gave me a few hypnosis treatments, and I seemed like I generally kind of slept through them or whatever, and I didn't even, you know, anyway, it was interesting. So when I went to go listen to her do a public speaking, and among other healing people, you know, I listened to the people that spoke before, and then when she got up to speak, I went to sleep and I couldn't believe it, but I heard everything she said. And then when she was done, the next people came along and spoke, and I was awake again. And I'm going, oh my gosh, can you imagine what that is? If that's going on in our life out there right now, and I'm seeing that kind of thing take place, does that sound like you've seen anything like that?
Sounds like invasion of the body snatchers to me. I'm telling you what, I was watching a couple of movies, and I have seen skeletal structures that were not what we have been taught to look like human beings underneath the skeletal structures. Me and Nordica both saw them one time, going, what? That was weird, wasn't it? You know? So sometimes outside the whole anti-communitarian league and my very serious philosophical challenge to the communitarian network and their entire theory of communitarian development is the possibility, in my book, that these suckers are going to start shape-shifting on us someday, you know? It's like you're waiting for their skin to fall off their faces, and you're like, what is behind that? Because the platitudes and the way that they play it, like Clinton, both Clinton, Hillary, and her husband, Bill, are the ones going around dropping the word communitarianism here and there. Clinton said it 5 times in the last year in public speaking engagements that we all need to be more communitarian now, you know? And I look at them, and I watch them, and I remember seeing him on David Letterman playing the sax or whatever a long time ago, and thinking, what a cool guy, you know? know how embarrassing that is. If that was my reaction. He played sax, I'm a musician, the guy's cool. You know? He's got a cool wife. It was all good. I didn't ever have any animosity towards the Clintons. I, you know, I'm being a feminist and raised on the whole feminist, you know, brainwashing of the 70s, which, you know, it should have destroyed my life, but somehow it didn't. I don't know. You know, I'm a survivor of all of those programs and all that brainwashing, but yet I still have all kinds of issues that are triggers for me, that are emotional. You know, I have ties to certain belief systems. I just don't want to give up, even though, you know, and the problem is we believe in the good. Americans, as a rule, I think, believe in the good. We believe the good first. We don't like the bad. I had eugenics stuff in my girlfriend's house in, down in Kent, Washington. I was studying because I didn't know what that meant, and it was tied into my research. It was part of my thesis, actually, so I had to go study eugenics. And my friend Patty found that sitting on her coffee table and told me to get that horrible stuff out of her house, and she never thought that I was that kind of person, that I would have such horrible literature and get it out right now, you know. And I had to tell her, you know, I'm studying this. This is part of what I'm writing about. She goes, well, that's sick. That's just sick, 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 you know? And I never thought it of you. And she actually, her opinion of me changed for a while because she thought that I liked that. You know, why else would I read it, okay, if I didn't believe it or something?
Yeah, but look how close. But look how close eugenics is tied to population control.
Planned Parenthood, and Margaret Sanger, and that whole crowd of all the druggies—it that ties them to Aleister Crowley. Okay, that's where it gets yucky and really yucky, as far as I'm concerned.
Go ahead, Lark.
Oh, forgive me. I was just going to say the politically correct term that they're banding about today is epigeneticist as well as bioethicist.
They
invent new language so that they can cover up what their motives and aims are.
I mean, how many people do you know that you can go out there and say, well, is this planet too populated and whatever? And I cannot believe how many of the percentage of them will tell you yes, and yet, and how that blurs into the eugenics thing. And it's really hard to separate it and explain. And I'm not even sure I can. How about you, Nikki?
Well, I tell people that the movement comes people that never intermarried. You know, the rest of the nations of Europe, when they moved somewhere and took over a joint and made it a colony, they intermarried with the locals. The British never did. You know, their bloodlines had to stay pure or whatever. You know, their aristocracy, you know, we could beat them easy. These people are whips. They got the bloodline, the Merovingian bloodline or whatever they, you know, I mean, they got all these different theories about who they are, who the servants are, who the red dragon is, all that kind of crap. But the bottom line is we're stronger than them. Our American mixed blood is way stronger than anything they've ever encountered, and that's probably the best thing we've got going for ourselves, is our health. In spite of the food they give us, in spite of the poisonings and the vaccinations and the mandatory this and the mandatory that, you know, they really have given us a steady dose of bad food and bad information for years, and how did we ever survive, you know? And who are we now as a nation, and what are we looking at? We're looking right at these people, right in the eyes and going, you got to go. There's all these kick the bums out posters. I love those, because that's it. If you're free, that's all you got to do, is kick the bums out. That was my first thing with Desioni, is he needs to be fired. I wrote the FBI. He's doing an investigation on this guy, you know? Who is he? Why do we have an Israeli special forces terrorists advising our presidents in the United States? This is a question that I got to ask, and I didn't care how politically incorrect that was. It didn't have anything to do with religion. It had to do with politics.
Well, I don't see it any different than the commissions that they have that they get in to investigate themselves. I mean, they don't go anywhere.
No kidding. Yeah, and you know, the whitewash, it also hides, you know, I mean, like all of the, I read a lot of exposés, like I just read Lies My Teacher Told Me by James W. Lowen, and the cover has a big thing by Howard Zinn that every teacher, every student of history, and every citizen should read this book. well, what these people are doing is twisting up the worst history of Western civilization, and then the conclusion at the end of the book that they get into is how nations have outlasted themselves, and now we need a global regulatory commission to protect the common good. You know, so even your exposés are going to head that direction, and our children across the board are all being told that they have got to teach their parents, much as the Khmer Rouge told those children that they needed to teach their parents. And gee, if population is a problem, well then why not get rid of the ones that won't let go of their old-fashioned, very detrimental to humanity beliefs, you know? Because that's what they say, my belief system in the power of my nation and the strength of my nation and the duty of my government to protect my liberty is so far gone, you know. And there's nothing for it. Aristotle, Plato, all the way back, all the Greek philosophers and stuff, they didn't believe in what we have at all. So whatever it said about the Republican there, you know, I'll go look that up sometime. But the reality is, you know, what we have, you know, it has morphed into something. And I think that we're kind of an unknown in a way, you know. You see that too? You know what I mean? That we're not all one consciousness. We're not all one collective. There's a lot of individuals here that are thinking, you know, what they're thinking. But I'm kind of up in Alaska by myself really right now. So where are you, Melody?
I'm in Colorado.
Colorado.
Uh-huh.
Right. Beautiful Colorado.
I've lived in Seattle and Colorado.
But you're in Texas now.
And I'm in Texas, yeah.
And that's a beautiful place. And so, I mean, you know, there's beauty everywhere. The problem is they've got us thinking that you know, we're so different. But if we're all given good information with the ability to think for ourselves, it's amazing how much we are alike. But when you get out there and you start looking, you find that, man, there is a lot of people with agendas out there to make sure that we, you know, are kept separate through disinformation, misinformation.
I wonder what would happen with American psyches if we all came to the full realization that we have no right to private property anymore. What if that really sunk in?
Well,
I'm
don't know. It depends upon
thoughts.
It depends upon if they're under their spell that day. I don't know.
Lark, this is William Wallace speaking.
It's really a rather...
Most people understand that about taxes. Anybody I've ever known who owned a house said, I don't really own it. The bank owns it, and the city can take it if I don't pay my taxes. You know,
yeah.
I think they're already pretty much aware of that. You know, which is the strange thing about there's only 400 people or so living where I live, and there's no taxes here. So people don't move somewhere because there's no taxes, okay?
I think the Aborigine Americans had it right. I mean, what do they have? A tent? A few animals, maybe? Some seeds.
Well, actually, they had very big towns, some of them, too, and they had summer palaces and winter palaces. The Indians down in Seattle, they worked 5 months out of the year, and the rest of the time they made art and played music.
Yeah, and then not all of them lived in tents, either, as we know.
No, they lived in big, beautiful logs and all kinds of stuff. You know, depending on where they lived is what they used. And that was always my thing with Gertie, was like, let's use more locally available materials and make little huts for ourselves that we own with hardly any money. You know, my house right now that I'm sitting in, I built every inch of this thing. And last night we had a huge windstorm that was blowing like crazy out there. And after 3 years of living in them, I went to bed because I knew I was fine, you know, and I was. I got up this morning and went outside, and the only sign of the big windstorm was stuff blowing around, you know, in the yard. There's
mm-hmm.
nothing wrong with my dwelling. So there's a, you know,
no,
that's been a big plus.
No, I think it's a, I think what you're doing up there, Nikki, is a noble experience that, frankly, many Americans should experience. I know that I personally would love, if I didn't live with a really girly suburban type girl for, you know, for 23 years, I would do it in a heartbeat. You know, the whole idea of living
in a heartbeat. I don't know how noble it is. It sort of has that noble savage connotation that I'm not so sure I like.
Well, no. I think that you're quite a girly girl too. I just think that you're quite brave, is all. And, I admire that.
Well, there's a time when that would have been normal for what she's doing, though. So it just depends upon what time and place it's
Melody. I always thought I have a great admiration for the early pioneers in Alaska because I did a lot of shows dedicated, you know, Pioneer Days and Golden Days and the Fairbanks and stuff. Where, you know, I looked at all of the dwellings and went, whoa, them people were tough. You know, I mean, just walking here with your stuff over the Chilkoot Pass and finding out that you don't have to, it wasn't just one time those people walked up that pass. They could only carry 25 pounds at a time. So they had to go up to the top, put their load down, and go back to the bottom and get their stuff. And the Canadian Mounties, after a year of that big starvation thing, wouldn't even let them in without 300 pounds. So everyone who walked over the Chilkoot Pass was carrying 300 pounds on their back. It takes more than one trip to do that. Who were these people? And there was nothing there. It was a big scam to begin with. You know what I mean? I mean, there was some gold. A few people got rich. But the rest of them, you know, they didn't get nothing, okay? They moved on to the next joint. And they, who made the money was the Seattle companies that supplied them with all the goods, you know? And the guides or whatever. But it built towns and things up here happened. But the admiration that I feel for the people that built these tent cities all over, and all the way back to the beginning of time, I needed to know if I was capable of doing it. And what I found out in the process is you can make yourself very comfortable in a tent.
Well, it doesn't sound like times have changed all that much in the way they manipulated and socially engineered people to make their profits and that sort. But let me go ahead and do a station ID. And this is, you're listening to Truth Quest with Melody on KHEN LPFM Radio, 106.9 Salida, Colorado. Community supported radio, and we're streamed on the internet at khen.org. And my guests this evening are Lawrence Cumby, Cullen Lark, and Nikki Rapana. And I've also got a co-host that's sitting here, and he's had several questions, so I hope that he will go ahead and chime in here and have get a couple of questions across because... we have kind of a lively group, but he hasn't been able to kind of get his questions here. So go ahead, William.
Oh, okay. Well, going back to question one, I wanted to know how exactly the communitarian law is built into the contracts or the agency code that you mentioned. That goes way back to about the second minute of you guys coming on. That's just for starters.
Okay, did you hear that, Nikki?
Not, just pieces of it.
Okay, repeat that again, William.
How is the...
I wasn't able to hear. No, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yeah. How is the communitarianism law built into... contracts and agency code.
I think that maybe by design she may have to repeat what he's saying.
Okay.
Yeah, there's something.
Okay, maybe it's the microphone. Maybe that's what his problem's been. So that's probably why you haven't heard him. So he wanted to know. Are you there?
Is that Will?
Yeah, that was Will. And,
oh, great.
Okay. Well, no, this is a different Will, though. It's not the same one. But he wanted to know, living outside of how is communitarian law tied into something?
How is it built into our law?
Okay, how is it built into our law is what he's asking.
Okay, primarily through the main difference between a communitarian law and an American law that I have been able to figure out, and I've ran this past the criminal attorney, so, you know, I didn't get any dispute from him, so I don't think I'm wrong. But maybe, okay, you never know. But American law is based on property rights all the way down the line. Okay, in a criminal court, you're charged with a crime against a person, place, or thing, or whatever, and then the burden of proof is on the state to prove that you committed damages to these person, places, or things. Now, the severity of the charges against you, whether it's a misdemeanor or a felony, are the severity of the damages that you did to the person, place, or thing. Plus, there has to be evidence of damage to the person, place, or thing before you can be charged. Like, there has to be a dead body before you can be charged with murder, okay? So that's our criminal system in a nutshell. Now, communitarian law is behavior modification. Under a communitarian law, you are charged with the crime of potential cost, potential harm, potential damages. So there doesn't have to actually be any damages in a communitarian case. You just have to be charged with the potential, which would be a DUI, a driver's under the influence. You haven't actually crashed your car and hurt anybody or done anything. You're being charged with the potential to crash your car and hurt somebody based on the fact that other people having the same physiological condition as you created, committed the crime.
Okay.
So you're being charged with someone else's behavior.
Okay, well, it was pilot error on my part, and it was very frustrating for William here. And so he should be able to speak into the mic now. Try it, William.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can.
Okay.
Did you hear that?
Yeah, it was
there?
A button wasn't pushed.
Oh, huh.
I was talking to a dead mic.
Well, I explain this in my book, 2020, and I don't normally plug my book very much, but 2020, Our Common Destiny, is my personal story of how I found them and what I basically uncovered about the law. It's mostly about the law. It's a very short introduction to communitarian law and the process that I went through, and that's what I ran past this lawyer of mine.
Your book in the libraries today?
Pardon me?
Is your book in public libraries today? Can we look it up there?
No, we haven't sold any of them anywhere except for on my website. We're just now starting to maybe go into hard copy and combine it so that it has a binder that libraries like, binders. Right now it's spiral binding, and we've been self-publishing it since 2006, I think, is when it first came out. And it's been mostly to ACL people, you know. In fact, it's all been through. We haven't done any advertising at all. And we will start maybe at some point. I'm just not that big on promotions, you see. I'm not a marketer. I'm learning this. It's a very hard process for me. And the last thing I want to do is try and promote my opposition to these people, because it's already pretty standard. Adhere to communitarian law every day. And they do call it that in the European Union, especially in the environmental courts. But in the United States, it's called, and actually European community law. And it's anything that protects the community from the individual, basically.
Okay, and tell us your blog site. And, Lark, did you have one too, by the way?
Please forgive me. Repeat, Melody.
Okay, do you have a blog site?
No, not really.
Okay,
not,
all right. Okay, Nikki, give us your blog site.
NikkiRapana.blogspot.com.
Okay, so I'm making you just get a little more. The way you get used to doing that is just saying it a few times, and then it starts to get a little easier.
It sounds rude. Doesn't it say your own name or the address? Like, I became an address.
Nikki, how do you spell your name?
My name is Nikki Rapana, Rapana.
Oh, Rapana.
And I married that name.
Ah.
Yeah. But we say Rapana. Pat said Rapana. My ex said Rapana. Everybody said Rapana except for his mother. He pronounced it properly. But it's Finnish. My ex-husband's father was from Finland, and my maiden name is Friedrich, And according to my father, I'm a direct descendant of Frederick the Great. But who can prove these things, you know? And who really cares who you are and what your last name is? Because the America that I grew up in, it did not matter. What mattered was who you were in that moment, you know? People were able to start over in this country that had been charged with all kinds of weird things and horrible stuff and change their lives around. And I always liked America for that, you know, that it didn't matter where you came from and how much money was in your pocket. It was how hard you could work and do you throw down. Do you care about other people? And will the community accept you, you know? Some people go places where it's really hard to get accepted. You know, the friendliest place in the entire United States that I've been is Wyoming. They wave at everybody and yell out the window, welcome to Wyoming and stuff. You know, I stayed there for a year and a half, and I was only went there for 6 weeks. So there's places where you can go and you can really feel it. And are these educated people? No. Do they understand what's happening and how many government agencies are taking control of their land? No, they do not. But do they know that there's something wrong with sticking wolves in a cabin field? Yes, they do. You know, I don't know what's going on down there in Texas, but I know that they've done some weird stuff up in Montana, Wyoming, and Idaho and stuff, and all in the name of rewilding the whole country with animals that people spent decades killing off bears that were attacking their children at the school buses, and now they're reintroducing grizz in those areas. You know, the people in this country are seeing it happen everywhere they live. The closer you are to a designated wilderness or some kind of corridor, you see it. So you already know those people know. Their gut is telling them something is very wrong here.
Yeah, you know, that word itself, corridor, is an interesting word. I when I just came back from Texas, I ran into a safety corridor. Now, I mean, it's being applied to all kinds of things. What is a corridor?
A corridor is one of their bureaucratic terms for a road or a roadless area that they control 100%. They also plan to control hundreds of miles around their corridors to protect the corridor from, you know, encroachment of the humans.
But why did they go to that terminology as opposed to highway or something, you know, another terminology? Why did they pick up on that term, I'm wondering?
I don't know. I really don't know. I do know that conservation originated with the British in India. And all you have to do is look at the history of Gandhi and see how well that program went over there. So to me, that was always a bad sign that when Teddy Roosevelt created the National Park System and Gifford Pinchot became the director and they made Yellowstone a special exclusive hunting ground. And the first guest there that Wild Bill Cody invited was, you know, the Prince of England or the Prince of Wales or whatever. You know, I mean, it's a big boys club. It's always been a big boys club, even in America.
They wanted to show off the prince's property.
Yeah. They the whole title, it should be Communitarianism and How They Took Back the Colonies.
Well, I...
Say that again. Say that again.
Communitarianism is How They Took Back the Colonies. No, I'm stumbling over it.
Yes, Connollys.
Yeah, it is, the colonies, you know, because that's how I feel. I feel like it's, I ended all my emails for years, all hail Queen Beatrix, because Beatrix is the presides at the Beast Palace in the Netherlands. This is where the International Court at The Hague is, and this is where the Earth Charter rests, no kidding, in the Ark of the Covenant, called by Mikhail Gorbachev and Marie Strong the Environmental Ten Commandments. So what these people believe that they're imposing on America is God's law.
But
yeah.
But at the same time, you're saying that it's God's law, but they kind of took out the terminology.
God's not in this picture. Or maybe the devil is. I don't know what they exactly believe in, okay? Some kind of old ritualistic weirdness that I can't relate to, and I'm not interested in their religions. I try to avoid their religions because they got so many of them, and then they try to blend them all together into one and sell it to me as the whole package. So now I'm supposed to worship Mother Earth, and you know, so it's definitely in complete defiance of biblical principles. The Christians were the first people I found that had a clue what this was, okay? And they do use the term communitarianism. Barrett Keogh's of Keogh's Ministries right now just did an article on News Reviews last month explaining communitarianism again, and she's written about it quite a bit. Of course, they won't, they don't like to cite me because I talk about Israel and the Zionist implications of and many of the Christian groups that, you know, are aware. They're also dispensationalists or Zionists or fundamentalists or, you know, Christian right. I don't know. You know what I mean? They got all their other attachments that they bring to the table, and that's the thing about Americans. They're very diverse. I don't think two people in this country can reach consensus, let alone the whole country.
Well, the interesting part of it is that you just brought out right there, they can be, we can all be so keyed into what's going on in one wedge, and then you can go turn around on, and they find another way to wedge into control over us through another means or method, and we don't even recognize it.
Right, and the more conflict between us, which is the goal, communitarian solution, if you don't have a problem that needs solving. And this, and the problem is always between two ideologies that have to battle it out in the streets, hopefully. Hopefully the best, according to Hegel, is when it's violence or leads to war. The best conflict is when a lot of people die and it's really bloody and horrible, because that moves the solution into the forefront, and nobody will deny the need for the solution because the death and destruction has been so horrible. These people love conflict and chaos, and they, everything that they do is about getting you and me to fight. The last thing they want is for us to agree right now on anything.
Well, one thing that I would like to interject here is that, you know, how can we ignore the Zionist angle? It comes from
how
another
ignore any angle. Yeah, they're all
part
of it.
Yeah, I agree. However, I mean, we've got the head of the Communitarian Network, the founder, is a Zionist. We have people like Lloyd Blankfein. Yeah, we have the people like Lloyd Blankfein quoting recently that Goldman Sachs is doing God's work. Who's God?
Really? Hallelujah, brother.
Yeah, but certainly, you know, you have to ask yourself, well, would that be a Jewish God, or would that be a Christian God? Would that be a...
I thought it was a money God.
What kind of God?
God of the Illuminati.
I think it's the fish God. I'm a member of the Salmon Nation, and we all worship the salmon.
Oh, you're not a Catholic, are you?
Is that a fish God, too? Yeah, they're all fish gods.
The Pope's costume is a
fish. I went and looked up the fish god, and he's pretty funny looking. I'm not sure I want him for my god. I'm looking for another one right now, you know. But, I mean, I was raised Christian, so I wasn't all that interested in other religions because I was taught that they were, you know, I didn't need them. Not that there was nothing wrong with them, exactly. Maybe Catholicism because we were Protestant, but the rest of it, no. And I, all my years in Alaska, I came up here in 74, and I was outside the college in, like, the 80s, right? But I didn't know what anybody was. All my friends, I didn't know what religions they were. It was amazing to me when I got to the East Coast, when I went to Massachusetts, finally, to college in 84, that everybody wanted to know what religion I was. And I started saying, I'm Alaskan. We don't have religion. Right? Because they were obsessed. The Jews had to know, are you a Jew? And the Catholics had to know if I was a Catholic, and the Greek Orthodox, I don't know how I would end up being one of them, but, you know, they wanted to know if I was in their church, you know? They care so much in Massachusetts. I was so out of touch with America that I thought a Jap was a Japanese American. I didn't know, I never heard the term Jewish American princess. There were so many things that they had as part of the WASP mentality. The white Anglo-Saxon Protestant thing, I had never heard of that. You know, the West Coast is a different place than the East Coast. And I bet the Northeast Coast, and you know, if you go to college in Florida, I'm sure it's not the same as UMass Amherst or Boston, you know? We are a very diverse country. We've always been. And, you know, somehow we all got along. And I think what the goal of the communitarian agenda, I mean, absolutely, is to divide us and push issues on us that have nothing to do with us as Americans.
Yeah, but they do that.
A lot of my friends are immigrants.
But, yeah, they do it at the same time of saying we're one. I mean, we're all alike. I mean,
it's diversity with unity, and they have a platform for it because they're going to fix it. They said we couldn't get along, so now they're going to make sure we do.
So
we already get along.
Yeah, so that goes back into that. Go ahead, Lark.
Oh, no, they call it heaven on earth, the kingdom message, among other things. But
and I think whatever it appeals to, if you're already a Christian, they're going to appeal to your Christian sensibilities and motives, and they're going to come at you through your... My local church is having a Jesus revolution. I laugh. I'm like, what the heck? How did they combine Marxist ideology with Jesus? Oh, I'm sorry. I missed that class, you know?
Well, the Catholic churches certainly have, and so have the Protestant fundamentalist churches. They very definitely combine Marxist ideology with communitarianism, and there's no doubt.
Well, no, the communitarianism, according to the Jesuits that I studied in Brazil, communitarianism is the synthesis between the ideologies, and the priests knew it. John Paul II used the term. Gorbachev knew the term. You know, now all the books that are written about these people say somehow they just learned it from God or what, okay? They don't tell you how they knew, but how come they all use the same word to describe the same synthesis that they believed was the only thing that could save the world? Because there's this pressing problem called overpopulation or, you know, climate change or, you know, whatever, you know what I mean? They've got their emergency situation, but the only thing that can save the world right now is if everybody becomes more communitarian. Just listen to Clinton, you know? That's the solution. And the advantage of having go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, an important book that kind of will take note of the another aspect of the historical evolution for the thinking which inculcated the churches would be Helen Peters' book, The Union Jack. That book, for me, brings a lot of things together because it touches upon the religious aspects of the dialectical conflict.
Right. The problem with the Union Jack, and I have to say this, Lark, is it's unverifiable and it's unsourced. Now, people think somebody named Helen Peters published it, right?
Well, it doesn't matter. It's really only the ideas. It doesn't matter if it's even a real person for me.
Well, it does matter. As I'm a nonfiction researcher. And all of the information that I use to come to my conclusion has to come from verifiable sources. So as wonderfully presented as the Union Jack is, your listeners need to know that when you start citing books that you cannot authenticate or verify anything for yourself, you've already lost the argument.
Okay, now let me point something out that I read. This was my lesson for the last week or so. I went down and I did a bunch of research on some things that should have been, you know, it was in public knowledge and that sort of thing. And I found out that I could go from a clerk's office to a tax office to from one courthouse to another courthouse, from one library to another one, and find out, and even from the sources, birthplace and whatever, that they, you know, there's so much misinformation floating around there that even when it's documented source, and that's what should be in your court records and your clerk records and that sort of thing, you find a lot of weird stuff that doesn't match up. That's just what I'm not saying that sourcing shouldn't be done, but I'll tell you, I was kind of scratching my head when I was done. So.
Well, the reason I'm saying that is because I've had quite a few Christians come at me from different angles, okay? And some of them, you know, with the Union Jack, which I actually started listening to before my laptop crashed. I had a CD sent to me of an audio of the book, and this really horribly boring man reading it, so that didn't help, okay? So I only listened to, like, the first couple chapters of it. And it's speaking distinctly to a Christian audience. You know, so there is another piece that is really hard for me when it starts. To me, the Christian church is so in the middle of this dialectic. I don't know where it stands, okay?
But it isn't just the Christian church. I mean, these guys have aimed at everything, and that was one of the things when I did a recent interview with David Icke, but I also got some documented information from Vicki Davis, who put it on her website, Channeling Reality, of it isn't one of many, many, many conspiracies. It's one. So they appeal to each person's weak point and find a way to get us all to work into this program and agenda that they've had set up for a long time.
And to get past the pinky in the brain mode, which is where most of us go, you know, like, whatever. You hear that a lot. You know, how ridiculous is that? That could never happen. You know what people said to me in Seattle all the time? Like, that's not possible. Why would they want so much information? Why would the police want to get into so many people's houses? Nikki, they will never regulate private property in the United States. Democrats told me that. Active elected Democrats told me that. So, you know, people, even your small-time elected representatives, they still believe that the basic principles of protecting private property were intact because they, most educated people that understand the law, they also know that if there is no private property, there is no law. It's gone. What's your law based in? If there's no private property, then I can kill anybody I want. Damages are no longer against the law, because that guy, you know, he was bad for the community. That's the defense. You'd win if you did that. You know, it's crazy. So people get into the court system, and they think they're under constitutional law, and then there's this whole thing about maritime law, but it's a whole other issue, land of law of the sea and all that, you know. But the basic thing is people go into American courts defending themselves, thinking that they have Fourth Amendment rights, Fifth Amendment rights. They, you know, the Bill of Rights is so short, the original 10, that most people have a basic concept of what's in there, you know. Now, the fact that the police have a different mission statement than protecting and defending the constitutional rights of the citizens that they've been employed to protect, most people don't understand that. They never look at the mission and goal of their local police department. That's one way to learn about communitarianism. Look up your local police department website and read their mission statement and their goals. And it will say, create a livable and healthy community for a sustainable future, somewhere in there.
What does that mean, sustainable? I've yet to kind of sustainable to who, you know? Is it sustainable to
an
elite?
It was defined by the Brundtland Commission in 1987 by the United Nations commissioned it, and it's like to provide for the needs of the future while seeing to the needs of the day. And if you just want to look at the Marxist platform, the basic thing that came out, to each according to his need, to each according to his ability, then you understand what sustainable development means. It means taking from the rich, giving to the poor, or actually taking from the rich and giving to the richer, and then telling the poor, we'll give you some later. Things you work for.
There you got it.
About a third year. It's about taking slaves. These people are slave traders.
Right. Well,
the most ancient, next to prostitution, what's the most ancient business on the planet? Stealing people.
Well, but that takes a little while to start uncovering all this unless you start getting into that admiralty and all that and realizing that, you know, if you got the symbol of skull and crossbones, I mean, isn't that kind of like, you know, tell you right there, the law of the sea?
Well, there's so many of those symbols. It's really creepy to look at those. There's a guy named Gary Kaw. Are you familiar with him?
No, I'm not.
Yeah, anyway, he has a website.
K-A-H.
Yeah, K-A-H. He's a religious guy, okay. But boy, he's got some stuff on there about symbols, and every one of them, CBS, NBC, all the big Time Warner, you know, and he'll tell you what every one of them means, too. So that guy spent some time on that portion. Now, I never did. When my conspiracy theory page at the ACL is really, really long, because I was called a conspiracy theorist when I started challenging the law. And I thought that kept me in a pretty upfront realm, you know. I didn't talk about aliens. I don't know anything about aliens. I don't know anything about it, the Illuminati or any. I didn't even know what those terms meant. I didn't know anything. All I knew is that you don't have the right to come in my house without a legal search warrant, and that's the law where I was born and lived my whole 53 years or whatever at the time I was 43 or whatever, you know. You don't get to come in without a warrant. They were like, what's wrong with you? Don't you want to live in a nice community? I said, yeah, I want to live in a nice community where the government doesn't just come inside my house and inspect it. They were going to inspect, which they will. This is coming to a community near you. Inside housing inspections for safety, global compliance with the standards, and this is part of the stimulus package and cap and trade, and there's probably other things out there now too. International Building Code. Everybody in America has to come up to International Building Code, and they have the right now to come in your house and inspect it, and then require you to install all these new, smart grid type things that are gonna cut down in your carbon footprint, okay? And then they're going to assess your carbon footprint, and then they're going to also do a background check on you, a financial check on you, educational testing, and determine if they can help you find a job, find a better job, start a business, or take you to an institution because you need mental help. And they're called mental police officers in the community-oriented
police. Where's that? In what program is that that's spoken of?
Community policing. It's called community-oriented policing. It's COPS, all caps, COPS. Huh. And one of the beginners, this is a program that Amitai Etzioni suggested under Clinton, and they wrote the Violent Crime Act, wrote community policing into it in 1994. They got the funding from Congress to employ 100,000 new police officers, and they spread them out across America. And they all have sniper training, and they're prior military. But they're nice, friendly neighborhood cops on bikes. There's one in Anchorage right now. They have community service officer cars all over. There's CSO cars. You've never seen them where you live? Well, anyway. Okay, in Anchorage, they're raping the drunk women that they're picking up. They just got caught another guy doing it, you know? So, you know, there's nothing legitimate about this program. They train citizen police to spy on the neighbors. It's a program called Neighborhood Watch, Block Watch. They have little parties. And if you look at Stasi records from East Germany after the fall of communism over there, you will learn that all of the practices that the Neighborhood Watch and the Block Watch are teaching to the Iraqis and the Americans both are the same programs the Stasi employed in East Germany under the communist regimes. No difference. And that's what they're doing. I found out about the database. That's how I really got involved, okay? My file was in this database, and it included gossip that my neighbors had told them, and I wanted to know what was in there.
By the way, Nikki?
Uh-huh.
I want you to know that I think I probably mentioned this in a blog post once or twice on your blog. I discovered the so-called Center for American and International Law on Democracy Drive, quote-unquote, in my neck of the woods here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. This is where they actually train the cops. This is where they actually train the lawyers and the judges to indoctrinate them to international law. You can actually see this. You can go to the website. It's C-A-I-L. C as in Charlie, A-I-L,
okay.
A-W, which is the Center for American and International Law website on Democracy Drive. And there's you'll find these types of teaching or higher education or extra educational facilities for people who already have their degrees, who are already in the communities, already working within administrative procedures. That head up the local police departments, the sheriff's departments, that are in the courtrooms. This has been going on since 1947.
Right after the Administrative Procedures Act of 1946.
That's right.
Interesting.
And so, for me, communitarian law is really just an extension of this tremendous avalanche of words and laws and statutes and regulations and things that people have to do to the, you know, to the point that we're like Gulliver in Gulliver's Travels. And the Lilliputians had to tie them up. In other words, we have so many things that are upon us that we, you know, it doesn't even make sense to want to own a home anymore. It doesn't make sense to want to own a business anymore because it's really not fun.
No, and they'd really rather that we all just committed suicide anyway.
Exactly.
Yeah,
they
but
just,
we have to do it.
All,
but we have to do it their way. They won't let us do it our way.
No, I mean, it will be regulated. They're going to make the maximum, you know, efficiency out of it or whatever. They're very efficient, you know.
And we have to remember that all of this is being driven by people who are basically a ring of counterfeiters. Because we, you know, look at the Congress can't even determine if the money has any backing. And no one understands the financial system because we have a private corporation that really is driving all of this.
Well, when they send out your census form and it has the United States Census and it has a registered trademark mark right next to it, it kind of makes you wonder who, you know, who's behind it all.
Oh, no, that was a laugh, wasn't it? did you just mention the last census? Is that what she's...
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that. that's part of the privatization, though, that was largely driven by Gore and Clinton. So, I mean, they're basically reinventing government, if you will. I'm sure Nikki's aware of that.
Ownership.
What now?
Doing all the work. Local Agenda 21, that was a big part of it. It recommended the partnerships and how to form the partnerships between the private sector and the public sector to cover these massive changes that had to happen at the community level.
Well, that's how they induced the corporatists, you know, to go along with the program because they would benefit. You know, they would get these dollars from the government, these sweetheart loans, and that they would basically become partners with the government in the same way that the foundations and the NGOs worked really with the socialists and the communists to indoctrinate us through the public education, the university system, etc. Even science and the arts today are all controlled by these people.
And fashion.
Through their dollar. Yeah, their fashion too.
Their fashion too. There's like not a piece of it now. See, that I've turned off the television years ago. And,
good for you. Me too.
I had to just because I was always arguing with it, you know, and I started feeling like maybe they are right. Maybe I am crazy because every time there'd be somebody on there, I go, shut up, that's a lie. You know that's a lie.
I almost wanted to shoot mine one night.
I mean, it can be not the worst in a person, you know. So, you know, and part of my recovery from the dialectic, which is ongoing. People always think I'm out of it, you know, because right under living outside the dialectic, it says seeking a path outside the plan, you know. It's not about finding one. If I knew how to do that, boy, I'd share it, you know. But the truth is, it's in my head. I was born in 1956 in Madison, Wisconsin. Everything I knew came from them. And so everything that I've unlearned, it's like very scary. It's like when a person first gets sober or comes off drugs and they don't have their endorphins back yet and they're empty inside because you've rejected something that's very poisonous to your soul. But at the same time, you're dependent on it and you have nothing and there's this like a little place in there where you have nothing for a while. Very scary for people. But then you start to fill it up again with you don't know what. And hopefully it's not another cult or another religious ideology or another, you know, something, but something authentic that is yours that, you know, stuff comes up. And all I've ever seen is little pieces of what Nikki Rapana might have been if I hadn't spent the first 40 years of my life indoctrinated with communitarian ideology.
Lark hit the nail on the head quite a while back in the conversation. He said, start asking questions, keep asking questions, keep asking. That's the big cure.
You have to. That's very good observation. You really have to. I know that in my own life, I was always taught that, my goodness, you got to get a good job. That was your whole mission in life. And if you didn't get a good job, you had to start a business. And you had to sell something. And so forth and so on. So I spent the first 20, 25 years of my life constantly trying to sell myself, and I wasn't quite sure I knew who that person was. All I know, I was trying to get by and be a good citizen, quote unquote. And then when I owned a business later on, a successful business for a dozen years, I found that I didn't enjoy it because I constantly had this, I felt like I truly was being terrorized, that I had to comply with this and I had to do that. And then I had to be responsible for all these different people. And it just took the whole joy out of it. And I fear that's what's happening with our economy today. Americans are quite ingenious. They're quite enterprising. But my goodness, if you want to start a business today, it's truly no fun. And so your mind immediately starts thinking of all the ways that you can circumvent all the darn rules just so you can enjoy your life and hopefully do something worthwhile.
I've often wondered if the system really wasn't designed for only those who break the rules. Those who make it had to find some way to circumvent it in some form or fashion. Because when you start looking at, if you follow everything they tell you to do, you're bound to fail.
But I was told in my restaurant by a local restaurant owner that I needed, the first thing I needed to do in order to make my restaurant work was cook my books. My response to him, my very naive 29 or 30, whatever the old response was, I'm a good person. I would never do that. You know, like, I was arrogant in my naive assumption that I was going to do things the right way. You know, I was going to be a good person in my life, and I wasn't going to lie. I wasn't going to cheat. I wasn't going to steal, you know. And when people told me that I needed to cheat or steal or lie, I always said, you're wrong, you know. Well, they were right. If I really wanted to succeed in any of the things that I was doing, first of all, I would have had to compromise my morality. I'm a woman. You know, you have to be for sale in a marketplace where you're a commodity. And you have to put a value on yourself and whatever, you know. I mean, it's yucky out there. I don't like it. I have ran from it. I'm single now because I can't deal with it. I can't deal with the fact that I've been treated like a commodity my entire life. That's not, you know, feminism talking. That's just reality. That's our system. That's what we've all been taught. You know, my value was, you know, the value of the man that I helped and my husband and stuff. And at the same time, that was the core strength of our country was our family unit. You know, these people aren't stupid. They've destroyed the family. And I'm a result of that, you know. Like you and I don't know how old you are, Melody, but our age group.
I'm in your group.
Yeah, we rejected all of the values that were really the good ones in the end, okay, when it comes out, when the truth comes out, you know. Loyalty to your family and, you know, monogamy and, you know, devotion. And humbleness and, you know, the work ethic and all those kind of things that my parents thought were so important, you know, they turned out to be pretty important to me later on. You know, they're not important to my kids' generation. Whew.
You know, it's funny, Nikki, you talked about your indoctrination as a good Christian American woman. I discovered in business, as I was able to parlay hard work into certain successes, and I was actually challenging for leadership in my particular field, that more and more people around me, I sensed very strongly, actually admired ruthlessness.
And the way
that you could inspire a sense of fear in your competition as the values that I should aspire to. And that's when I started to think, you know, this is really not fun anymore, because this is not who I am.
Yeah,
that's exactly it. What I see it is the system is totally broken, but it's designed. It works great for them if you don't have any ethics. And as long as you have corporations running things, that's, you know, that's the paradigm right there. There are no ethics. And we sat there and marketed the heck out of those things.
Right, because only individuals have it. I don't think corporations, governments, I don't think churches have ethics either, really, that I can see, you know. I think it's the individuals. But that's where it comes from. Well, and that's the thing that, like, to erase from the human consciousness is the idea that, you know, it's up to each one of us as an individual to determine what's right. And, you know, most
you
people
know what,
quote that whole rule thing.
You know what's ironic, Nikki, Melody, and William, I think? My mother was an atheist, and she was a feminist, but she always talked about morality and ethics. And so I grew up actually very curious about religion because, frankly, I was discouraged from going to church with my friends and all these other kind of things, you know, to the point that by the time I left home, I really wanted to study religion just because I knew nothing about it. And so that's why I have forced myself to study various aspects of religion over the years. Only so I can understand the indoctrination that other people have. And I've always questioned why the enmity between various denominations and within different religions. And because, frankly, a lot of that has driven history. And I had to come to terms with that. And so, you know, it's just like earlier you mentioned the word Christian, just the word stand alone. Well, my goodness, what kind of Christian? There were, you know, it's kind of like that word republic, or it's that word faith. There's many words like that we just batty about with unthinkingly, thinking that other people share the same definition for these words, and so we're really not communicating. If you think of democracy as one way, and I think of it as another way, I personally loathe democracy. I don't like it too much. In fact, I always hated it. If I was honest with myself, if I was with some of my friends and I'm 8 years old and we're drawing straws and I didn't get the right straw, I always hated it. Therefore, I thought it was kind of a stupid thing, if you understand what I'm saying. And yet today, we're all indoctrinated to think that, yes, consensus is good, and yes, we're all different, and so forth and so on. But
well, my dad always used to do it in the way where he'd say, okay, let's put it to the family vote.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, and then if you didn't vote his way, he either kicked the shit out of you, or did something, you know. So we learned what democracy was. Democracy means totalitarianism. One person makes all the choices and everybody else goes along. That was the way he taught us. We're a democracy, yeah. Right, kids? He'd say. We all go, yeah, we know what that is. You know?
Yeah, that's consensus.
So really, whenever the government in Seattle started using those terms with me, that's the thing about training and education. If your parents have any influence on you whatsoever, as soon as someone starts saying these things, as soon as they say, well, this is for the common good, I went, oh, no, I don't want any part of that. I know what that means. That means my dad's in charge of everybody. You know? And he would have, if I was such a fascist, he was like 82nd Airborne, totally U.S. Army, you know, drill instructor and everything, raised us like a troop. So a lot of the, you know, the warrior, you know, part of me comes from my old man. And but he was smart. He was smart in that instinctive, you know, German farmer smart. If something doesn't make sense, it doesn't make sense. If it quacks like a duck and it sounds like a duck and it walks like a duck, it's a duck. You know, he liked to. I asked him one time if I should trust his PhD that was coming to visit me and talk about community policing. He was a professor of criminal justice. And my dad said, I don't trust anybody. What's that? Yeah, he goes, I won't trust anybody with a PhD. So, you know, every family also has those triggers, you know, that you've been taught. If you grew up working class American, then no, you don't trust people with an education. And if you can't understand somebody, you just tune them out. Well, what our people don't understand is that when students say you can't understand what they're talking about, that's when you need to tune in and really listen and say, could you write that down for me? Because I need to go home and study that. That's pretty complicated stuff you're giving me. Sounds kind of important. Maybe I should read it later. I'll put it in my bathroom for me and all my neighbors, you know? Because that's where it's at. They do say everything. They talk about communitarianism like it's normal. In their own circles, you know?
When you're looking into things like law, we should all know by now that every word counts. Every word.
Yeah. V or A changes the entire law. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's what they count on, the fact that, you know, they've tried to, I think that, you know, the whole court system is skewed. I won't go through the courts anymore. I sued them. I worked on 3 different lawsuits in Seattle, and each one of them was a waste of time.
They're all corrupt today.
I was going through our statutes in this state, and I kept running across the terminology, which I'd never run across before, but there was tons of it throughout the book, and it was harmonizing. They were harmonizing, but it didn't state to what.
Yeah, that's a communitarian term. Harmonization, if you do a key search for that term, harmonization, you'd be amazed at how many legal documents from the European Union and the NAFTA, CAFTA studies and agreements and symposiums comes up under that term. Another one is Pierre Pascore, whatever. There's like 3 or 4 key terms that they use that a lot of people end up at my website looking them up. My communitarian law page is the one that, you know, if anybody wants to read up on what I found on the law, it's very long. You have to read it in one day for sure. And I don't know how many of the links are good, but it's http.nord, that's N-O-R-D, .twu.net/acl/comlaw.html. Boy, that's a long address. No wonder.
You know, repeat that twice so that, you know, repeat that again.
Okay, it's http://nord, N-O-R-D, .twu.net/acl/comlaw.html. And the
Nikki,
term is communitarian law.
Something that might help for the future, especially with the nature of radio and the listeners listening, is just tell them to do a quick search for Anti-Communitarian League and then go to the website and click research.
That's a good one.
I think I've read every word on that website.
You couldn't have read every word on that website. You wouldn't have any time left to do anything.
Well, I actually had that luxury of time.
a lot of it was appetitive, I think, on some level. And then other things I would start off on, you know, because everything is connected to communitarianism. It's a global system. It's a global theory. It's a global philosophy. It's global law. It's global everything. So it's huge.
That's why Amitai Etzioni is the everything expert.
Yes, exactly, because it encompasses everything. So you start trying to study it, and all you're doing is running down a million rabbit holes. Million, at least. And I spent years going down them, and when I finally came out of them and came up for air, I was like, wow, these people have all these ways to sucker my time, you know? So I think that helped a lot with our thesis, because when I stepped back from it, I started looking at the similarities between every situation I had been looking at, and all of them were based in conflict.
Nikki, I would like to read your thesis.
Say that again, Will.
With that?
Nikki, I would like to read your thesis.
It's for free online. Look up what is the Hegelian dialectic.
Okay.
You'll either get to mine or other people have reposted it. We also have it in hard copy available, but it's for free online and it'll stay there as long as the ACL is up. I'd like the hard copy. In 2002. And then I gave it to Etzioni for rebuttal.
While we're at it, Lark, what was that place in Dallas that you were telling us about that they were training the police? Repeat that again.
Oh, well, it's called the, let me see, let me reopen that. It's called the, forgive me.
Center for something law, CAILAW, you said.
C-A-I-L-A-W, is that?
It's A-I-C law.
A-I-C law, okay.
Yeah, let me be certain about that. It's called the Center for American and International Law is the name for it.
Center for
American. So if you just do a search for Center for American and International Law, it's on Democracy Drive.
Okay.
I love that it's on Democracy Drive. It probably
I'm on the E-list for the Jean Monnet School of International Law at New York University. And much of the... many of the papers that I've been getting from them lately are all just focused on addressing some of the problems with harmonization. So when you start looking for the harmonization and you go into these upper academic legal department, you know, it'll explain it, you know, maybe not right away for you or whatever.
But it's not just for lawyers either. It's also for really anybody that's in government, that's an administrator or... head of an agency, you know, all the...
Right,
because
they teach them how to implement these programs inside revised land management plans. If you look inside the matrix of your regional plan, you'll see their laws under, you know, numbers and letters, and then they tell you the agencies that are going to implement it and things.
Okay, now when we bring this to a conclusion... Okay, so we've talked all around this communitarian law, but what is its total objective once they get this thing totally in place and has it in their uppermost vision implemented? What would you say that, you know, what's in it for us?
I would say really only one word, but you can easily combine two. The first word I would say is slavery. And the second two words, it would be totalitarian slavery. This is their aim, and this is what they're achieving, and it's happening as we sleep, as we're awake. There's your short answer.
Okay, and
that is their, that's what their objective is. They truly want to enslave us, and they actually want us to love it. They want us to love our slavery.
But in the meantime, isn't it not like that those that are implementing this all is thought as they're going to be special and they're going to be exempted from all this? But when it really comes down to it, there's only got to be a few at the top that are going to even benefit from this, because somewhere along the line, we're all going to go in.
Well, that's the goal.
That's expendable in the plan, yeah. And they've already determined the... first of all, they determine if you're an asset to the community and they can utilize you somehow or identify problem. And under community policing, it's called problem-oriented policing, otherwise known as POP. And these are the programs that they've introduced across America to identify the people in the neighborhoods who deter the shoppers. Okay, that would be anybody that's scary looking. Anybody that's different, anybody that drives older junk cars, no junk stores in the yards, blah, blah, blah. It's clean up America for the shoppers. Everything has to look like a mall in, you know, in an upper class neighborhood. The standards are for the upper class shoppers, and it's all about upper class shoppers. So if you have anything that you don't, if you don't have anything to offer them, then I'm concerned that those people will, you know, go into did you ever read The Lottery when you were in high school? Remember that?
Get it out of your mind. You have any rights in America anymore, that's for sure.
So, right, and if you're selected, you go. If you're selected to stay, you stay. Self-determination is a thing of the past.
Yeah, they want good sheep that further their agenda.
But when it really comes down to it, in the end, you know, they start culling out the weakest links, and before you know it, it's feeding on the body, and ultimately, in the end, it has to feed on itself, and that's where, for me, and I'm no expert on it, but this is one of the lessons I felt Shakespeare taught, is that, you know, you can't even trust your mother, sister, brother, or yourself in the end, the way this type of I mean, they're psychopaths. And so ultimately, when you're talking about this mental...
The beast is eating its own tail, is what you're saying.
Right, right.
Yes, and what happens when it consumes itself?
Mm-hmm.
What do you have left? And that's where my invention called Gertie comes into play. Because I invented a little house that you can make out of anything that you can find that will work. And, you know, I mean, it started out as just a camping excursion that I was doing to clear my mind and get some fresh air. But as I went along and I really started drawing on all these ancient technologies for building and understanding that people always created an environment that was safe for themselves and that we have a nation of people who do not know how to even do the simplest, most basic thing, like go get water and put it in a bucket and heat it on the stove. They don't know how to start a fire. They don't know where to get the wood. They don't know if they're allowed. They don't know if they can get the permit to get the wood. How many government agencies they have to go through, because that's when you really feel like you're in Russia. Try and go get a permit to cut wood in America these days, you know. They've shut down the resources. You can't get anything. So even if you know how to take care of yourself, build your own house, and provide your own fuel and heat and water, You aren't allowed to. They've already gone that far. Local Agenda 21 controls all the resources already. And how dare you think that you as an individual have a right to some water or some air to breathe? These people are so...
Did you just drop off? Oops, they did. And this thing is like it drops them off right at the two-hour mark. That's really kind of interesting. That's the second time that's happened. Okay, you're still there, but I lost Nikki. And I'll try to get back and talk to her afterwards. But it's time to bring it to a close because I do have something else coming up afterwards. But I want to say thank you to you and Nikki, and thanks a lot for the great conversation. And I hope, you know, it benefited people in the process. And any closing comments, Lark?
Well, I want to thank you for having me on. I enjoyed it. I always enjoy talking to Nikki and now you. And
William Morris.
I will say in just in conclusion that Nikki's work is a very important repository for understanding communitarianism and communitarian law, and I highly recommend it. And I highly recommend that people discover for themselves if independence means anything and if it has value for them anymore.
And again, I want to say thank you, and I'm totally unprepared for my next part of the program. So here I don't even have music ready to go, but I will say goodnight. And again, thank you, Lark, and thanks, Nikki, even though you're not there now because she got dropped. So that was interesting, but we'll have you back again.
Well, thank you.
Okay.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.